You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Chris Clark. Good morning, Chris. It's good to have you here.
Very good morning to you, Clay.
So, Chris, the way the show starts is we're beginning a conversation, and you're the guest. So tell me, who are you? What do we need to know to start this conversation? How would you give us a quick, the bold strokes of your life?
Well, I'm a young boy in a grown man's body, and I'm a explorer by vocation and avocation. Yeah. I grew up on an island on Cape Cod, and I ran wild as a dog. So, and on one hand, I was trying to be shaped into a responsible human being, and the other hand, I just loved running over the salt marshes.
Wow. That's a great image. That's a great image. Is there anything else you want to add to that before we step in?
Well, I think a fundamental, it's more than just a warp thread. It's the carpet on which I've lived my life, is that I listen to the world, and I love listening to the world because everywhere I go, I hear song. I hear music.
Uh-huh.
And so my ears and my mind are very, very much shaped. I see in sound, so everything is very much shaped by acoustics.
Wow. 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 Yeah. That's really, really, really neat. You brought some music with you. So, and one of them is a Sting and Message in a Bottle. And we've got a live recording of that.
Oh, great.
We're going to share now. Do you want to say something before we play it or after?
Oh, just let's play it. I love this song.
Okay. Here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on, and I'm Eric Clay, and our guest on this hour is Chris Clark. Chris, I think you're the first guest I've ever had who introduced yourself as a young boy in an older man's body, even.
Mm-hmm.
Those aren't exactly the words you used, but I think I got fairly close to the message. Tell me about that young man. That boy.
Well,
where'd you get started?
It all started. I grew up, was born and raised on Cape Cod, in a town called Wellfleet.
Mm-hmm.
Which
is now a tourist town, but was it then? Yeah, probably not. Yeah,
not really. But it's the Outer Cape. So at the time, I didn't know that there were such things as Bohemians. We were surrounded by poetry, reading, music. Everybody was accepted.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I was also treated to a life of freedom of movement, in that my grandparents, my parents met because one set of grandparents rented the house to the other grandparents in two neighboring towns, Wellfleet uh-huh. and Truro. And anyway, I just was able to roam freely over the countryside, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And that became my modus operandi. I mean, I just, outside was where I wanted to be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I could never get lost. I was constantly exploring, and I was encouraged to explore.
Right.
So then that becomes your essence. That becomes my part of my soul.
It stuck with you.
It's never left.
It's never left. You could never get lost. Now,
figuratively or literally?
Right, right. And that's because of?
Well, because of the instabilities that our life throws at you. When I was 4 and a half, my dad left, et cetera, et cetera. The house was thrown into complete turmoil. We had no car, we had no money. But what you learn to do is you learn to survive, and you can either survive with your tail between your legs, or you can survive with your head up
right.
and your chest out and saying, I'm alive, there are people who love me, and the world is full of discovery.
Yeah.
And I was always encouraged to do that.
Right. And you when I asked you about not getting lost, you took it in a much deeper place than even I meant it at that moment, but that's right. When you learn to stand up and look out and survey what's around you, you may not know where you are, but on some sense you're not lost.
I'm infinitely confident of myself.
Yeah. Okay.
In that, not that I'm arrogant or self-centered, it's just that my soul has grounded.
Right. Right. I think a word for that now is resilience.
Yeah.
You have no fear of what you're going to run into, because whatever it is, you're going to still be there.
Right. Now, one of the things that happens when you grow up with such adversity, if you will, I wasn't in danger. There wasn't adversity mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. that.
Right.
It wasn't like being in the inner city. But the mechanisms, the defensive mechanisms and the strategies that one adopts as an 8, 9, 10-year-old boy, and you carry those through into your teenage years, and then you start carrying them into your adult life, and then it turns out that they're really not very functional as an adult.
Or they have to be radically changed. So what did you have to unlearn or relearn or reposition?
Oh, I'm still in the process.
I mean, yeah, I get it.
No, it's that a lot of times what I ended up doing as a young boy, I had two older sisters, and one of them was basically took the role of my mother. This is almost a therapy session, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's a story, and the stories are what you're comfortable telling, and that's the key.
Well, this is part of my tapestry, so
right.
to speak, right?
Yeah,
and it shaped a lot of my constant desire to explore and discover and share.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very risk tolerant.
Mm-hmm.
I'm risk tolerant to the point that I don't even know that I'm risk tolerant, and it's not literally. I mean, I live on the Arctic ice, you know,
right.
frozen ice, and go into the deepest jungles of Africa. And to me, it's totally exciting. There's nothing mm-hmm, to be mm-hmm. afraid of. And I remember one time having an expression that said, I'd rather be stepped on by an elephant than get hit by a taxi cab. That, if I want to go,
right.
you know,
right.
I want to go in that sublime sort of environment.
Right, 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 right. So what are the kinds of things that you learned that were so helpful as a kid that became a liability later in life?
Ah, over-dependency on myself and the lack. I learned early not to rely on anybody, especially not men,
uh-huh.
and not to know how to ask for help.
Right, 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 right. And it's here is where your lack of risk aversion and your fearlessness, in a certain sense, is not hubris, it's independence.
It's survival.
Yeah, yeah, it's an almost unrealistic independence. But that was survival at
right,
one point.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the sixth of seven kids, but there's a big gap between my older brother, 7 years, and when my dad died, and my mom was extremely depressed. We basically raised ourselves.
Right.
And there's a lot of fighting, and there's a lot of conflict, and there's a lot of stuff, and you just learn how to take care of yourself in that environment, and that's the best you can do.
Mm-hmm.
But we also wandered over square miles of land and abandoned farmhouses, and mm-hmm. we just tried to stay clear of the bulls and stuff that you could not necessarily predict on how they'd run. Because we really, I didn't really want to get stampeded down by a bull or the local equivalent of the elephant.
Right.
At least I wasn't ready at that point. And I have a more of a fearful streak than you do, but I'm not sure why. But yeah, I sense what you're saying, When you do that, it changes the course of your life. It's changed the course of my life. I've had to learn mm-hmm. a lot of different sorts of things. So you also brought more music with you, and one of them is this kind of lovely Vaughan Williams piece that is not at
Benjamin
all...
Benjamin Britten.
I'm sorry, yes. Benjamin Britten.
It could have been Vaughan Williams.
Yeah, no. It could have given... Yeah, yeah. But it's
Can I explain this a little bit?
Sure, let's do that.
So this is one of the parts of my life where we always were surrounded by music as a very young boy. We always had music.
So even before your dad left?
Oh, absolutely.
Music and poetry.
We would be listening to Mozart and Brahms and Beethoven and Chopin and whatnot. And my parents would always ask, who is this?
Yes. Right?
So we were... And we would always sing in the car, right? And we would have people over, and they'd be playing spoons and guitars. And so that was just natural, right? And so at the young age of 9 years old, I was, after my father left and they got divorced, and it took a while, about 5 years to get divorced, I was shuttled off to New York City, where my mother's three brothers, had all attended the Cathedral School of St. John the Divine and been boy sopranos in the choir.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, the school was a boarding school, and there were about anywhere from 38 to 44 boys. And you had voice lessons twice a day. You sang in the cathedral twice a day. So for 4 years, I was trained in the language of music.
Yes.
And it was complete immersion. And the cathedral is a phenomenal edifice of sound.
Yes.
And Benjamin Britten, when we were first learning ceremony of carols to mm-hmm, sing mm-hmm. for the Christmas season, the boys, those of us in the soprano mm-hmm, choir, mm-hmm. sang in a chapel at the end of the cathedral behind the high altar.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The men sang in their normal stalls
along the side,
and we had Decani and Cantoris, the two sides, and Alec Whiten, the master of choristers. And we were being conducted and directed by Alec Whiten mm-hmm. through a mirror.
Wow.
And the time delays, you had to learn to compromise and compensate's the better word.
Yeah.
Compensate for the delay between mm-hmm. the voices and the instruction. But when you're 10 and 11 years old and you're doing this, and we would go into the cathedral multiple times a week and practice this, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. It becomes natural.
Right.
And then Benjamin Britten isn't a hard piece to sing at once you've sung it, and everything else is mediocre.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's a metaphor for a lot of what I was going through.
Right. I'm also imagining the kind of... You grew up in an environment where you were exposed to really incredible classical music, but other music as well, and it was just normal. There was nothing exceptional about it.
Absolutely.
And when you go into that space, it's Cathedral of St. John the Divine, I can't imagine that you're not feeling both incredibly awed but incredibly playful. Because that's an awesome space to be in, and I... Mm-hmm. If you were a grinner, I can imagine you're stepping and grinning and just wondering what's going to happen next and listening. I don't know how they were in terms of the authoritarianism of conducting at that point, but they may have drawn it out from you.
No, Whiten was a phenomenal master of choristers. He'd uh-huh. been trained at King's College.
So he knew.
And he was a phenomenal organist mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. So But I, you know, now that you ask me, it's like, imagine being, I don't know how old he was at the time. Maybe he was 36 or 40.
Right.
And you have, you're looking at these 40 cherubic little kids.
Right.
And you're trying to train them and mold their voices mm-hmm. into one voice. And right. that's another thing I learned, and it stuck with me, is one of the fundamental components of a choir is you sing as one voice, unless
yes.
you're instructed to sing differently.
Right.
And that's what your ear is doing. You're constantly listening to make sure your voice is in complete synchrony with everybody else.
Right. Right. Which is, I can't help but think, given your freedom to roam on the Cape, that's the exact opposite approach to life.
Yes, I had a strong yin-yang
yeah.
upbringing.
Right, right. How was, did that feel like a good counterbalance, or how did you make the adjustment to that kind of order?
I've lived my life with that balance and counterbalance. Mm-hmm. There's always been yeah. that juxtaposition of analytical organization versus poetry and James Joycean kind of freedom or Escherish kind of weaving, going, you don't know whether you're going in or out.
Right. But it's the difference between the individual and community, where everything is something almost a level playing field or a space in which we all move versus the individual and society, where we are ordered and quite
yes.
tightly regimented. Yes. And you got to know how to play in both spaces.
Yes.
And that's a lesson a lot of people don't learn.
But
either
it's
they learn one or the other,
extremely exhilarating.
Yeah, 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 yeah. That's way, 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 way cool.
Yeah.
So you wanted to play a section from the Ceremony of Carols called how do you pronounce it? Vulcan Yule.
Yes.
Yeah, and the recording that I have is from the Ottawa Bach Choir, and these are women, mostly sopranos, who are performing it. They're not. This is not the boy soprano. If I'd have thought more, I would have gotten the right one.
That's okay. It's still beautiful.
Yeah. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. And this is the Made of Clay Report, and I'm Eric Clay, your host, and our guest on this hour is Chris Clark. That's a lovely little piece. So how did you take that yin-yang childhood of extremes and then move into adulthood? You know,
you're assuming that I moved it. Well, I did move into adulthood. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think is
playfulness
you've
is
managed.
Still there.
Well, no. But I would argue that there is no child that is not ancient, and there is no adult that does not have a child. You know, if they're really kind of fully alive and mm-hmm. fully functioning on all cylinders, as it were. Yeah.
Well. A series of things have happened to me in my life, which are, you might say, were serendipitous,
mm-hmm.
but they were almost bound to happen.
Mm-hmm.
In that, in my academic, my young academic years, I went into engineering.
Uh-huh. How the heck did you do that?
Well, you know, I don't know if they still do this in high school, but when I was in high school, they gave us these tests, right? And they say, this is going to help you figure out what you are, who you are. Right. Well, I came out as either a farmer or a physicist, which I thought was interesting at the time, but I had no idea what it was about.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, I applied to Stony Brook University, and we were living in outside of Albany at that time. And I went to Stony Brook and into the engineering school, 90 males. That was it, the old days, right?
Right.
But it was boring after about 2 years, and I was doing very well. And then I decided, oh, I wanted to do something with biology.
Right.
So I came up with my own five-year double degree program, went to the dean and all that kind of stuff. So I went into biomedical engineering, which at that time was quite young. And I was particularly interested auditory prosthetics, which are sort of an advancement of hearing aids. And through a class I took in biology, which was supposed to be a gut course, it was in animal behavior, and I walk into this class, and there's this guy talking about bees dancing and wolves howling and whales singing. I thought, wait a minute, you can study this stuff? This is what I grew up with, right? I grew up with everything from the Just So stories to river otters, and, you know, I had a parrot in the grape arbor outside the house, and, you know, this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So there was this, ooh, that's interesting. Anyway, I met, I was in a double degree program in an MD, PhD thing, and through my professor, who was becoming a very good friend, and is still a lifeline friend.
And this was in grad school. This was after.
I wasn't even in grad school.
Oh, you weren't there yet.
I was in this, starting this PhD, MD program.
Right.
And through this friend, I met this family that was heading off to Argentina for a National Geographic expedition. And they asked me if I would join the expedition, so I took a leave of absence from school, went to Argentina, joined this expedition. The next thing I know, I'm living in a tent on a beach in Argentina in a bay in the middle of nowhere, the same distance south of the equator as Cape Cod Bay is north of the equator. Many of the same species. It was the same thing, right? It was like, oh, right? It was, you know, this sort of C.S. Lewis kind of woof kind of thing. And I'm looking at them, and they're all musicians as well as two scientists, right? And I'm going, wait a minute. Somebody pays these people
to do this,
to be explorers and live in tents on a beach in southern Argentina. Not bad. I never went back to medical school. I jumped over, did a degree in engineering because I knew what I wanted to do.
And acoustical related stuff or some, what did you pick?
It was in electrical engineering, but it was, I knew I needed to build a machine. So I built a machine. But that whole warp thread that was developing was, again, it wasn't just serendipity, right? I was available to that change of my life. And it was then, and it's something I wrote you before,
yes,
which was, it was then that my vocation and avocation became one and the same. I'm not one to go on vacations.
Right.
Right. I don't go on cruise ships,
right?
Because it's like, no. I'm going to go and live on the Arctic ice for 3 months.
Right.
That's a holiday.
Right.
My sisters think I'm absolutely crazy, but it's...
You may also never retire, unless you...
I don't know what retirement means.
Well, yeah, that's, right? I mean, my children say, Dad, you've been living your retirement. It's your entire adult life. But
I'm having too much fun.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that happened along the way, which I think really was, in many ways, serendipity, was my cousin introduced me on a blind date to this woman who is my wife and has been my wife for 34 years. And we went to Argentina. We went back to Argentina with Janie, and we lived there for 2 years in the midst of nowhere studying the lives of whales. And it was magical. It was hard, but it was magical.
Right. We're going to come back to the natural stuff, but you just introduced, you know, at about the age of, what, 32, you meet the person who becomes your wife. How does, an explorer, an adventurer, and a scientist who's had some dad issues. Partner with a person. What do you have to? What have you had? And this is not about her. This is about you. What have you had to kind of face? To kind of because you speak of that with great fondness.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an easy transition.
No, and I will. I do want to mention that.
Sure.
I fell in love immediately.
Uh-huh. You knew.
That was it.
Yeah.
So the one of the tensions, if you will, is my sort of almost internal demands for freedom and spontaneity and risk, right? And this is difficult in a relationship.
Yes.
Because then you have to balance it and say, well, wait, this isn't fair, or this isn't right.
By some standard or some judgment that the other one has.
Both.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And Janie is incredibly tolerant of me in terms of my, you know, some of the things I just said, well, let's do it this way. And you go, no, that's, but I've learned so much from her about, because I totally trust her, right? There's that she loves me. And then you suddenly realize, oh my gosh, what a lucky person I am to have someone who will care for me, tolerate me, but try to, you know, not, she doesn't shape me. She just teaches me.
Is with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Is there, I would imagine, but the image that comes to mind is when somebody is alongside you, observing with you, with perhaps an arm around or just the presence. What, I want to go back to something that's a really dumb question, but I love dumb questions. And that is, what did it mean to you? What changed in you when you realized you were or you had fallen in love at that very early instance?
I was exceptionally happy.
Mm-hmm.
It was as though something that I never expected to happen suddenly was there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's almost as though I was just transported through this, into this completely different space where it's about us.
Right.
I don't know how else to say it. It's just
what I see in your story, and it may be projection, but it may be, there may be some truth in it. You talked about how being that explorer and being that independent character, all of a sudden your life wasn't your own. When you fall in love and you're happy and you're open in that way, there's not, you're not necessarily just on your own. That's been, you know, my personal experience is that, whoa, you know.
Well, I'm married to a wonderful woman who is very generous with my idiosyncrasies and my exploration.
Yeah.
So that's where, and we have enough of a sharing component in our two lives where when we are doing something together in synchrony, it again, it's this, you know, 1 + 1 = 10.
Yeah. Kind of thing. Yeah. You amplify each other's presence and effect.
Yep.
Yeah. Cool. Let me do the station ID. Let's cut to music. Think about what you want to go to next musically. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Chris Clark. So what should we play next?
Lady Antebellum, Need You Now.
Oh, yeah.
A quarter after 1, I'm all alone and I need you now.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and Chris Clark is our guest. So, Chris, what has surprised you about your life? What's worked out kind of, what happened that you never would have anticipated happened? What's worked out better than you dreamed, and what just shocked you in not being real at all?
Well, I must say that life has been exceptionally generous. Some of that is where I was born, how I was born, families, friends. There were friends of my grandparents who came to my aid, if you will, when I was 19 years old, who, you know, helped. Because at that point in my life, I was struggling with my identity. I was in college, but I didn't really know why I was in college. You know, you were getting bored at that point. You go to college, this is what you're doing. So that was one thing that was very moving for me as I grew older. Another example was down the dirt road on the island in which I grew up in Wellfleet, Mass. There was a family, and my two older sisters and I would go walk down the road on Halloween and go visit them. And we just knew them as the Biddles. And later on, when I was in my late 20s, I got an envelope from a law firm saying that Mr. Biddle, Sir Francis Biddle, as it turns out, had remembered all of us in his will. Now, Sir Francis Biddle served as the Secretary of State, right? And these are the kinds of people that you knew, you grew up with, and
you didn't know at the same time.
No, you didn't care whether they had epaulettes or badges. Yeah. They were just good human beings. So those are some of the twists and turns. And then the other turn in my life that happened was when I came to Ithaca. And that was, I was in a very traditional academic trajectory. I was at a very prestigious place called the Rockefeller University in New York City. I was
back in Manhattan,
a young starting up professor, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I was offered a position here, or I could compete for a position at Cornell that was at the lab, then the Laboratory of Ornithology, which was this little podunky building. And that same professor that in whose class I heard about wolves howling and bees singing and, you know, whales dancing and whatnot. I was like, oh, he offered me the job, but it meant that I left my academic tenure track position and I took a risk.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I could start this new program. And it was all about sound.
Uh-huh.
So when I was exposed, when I came to Cornell and I went around the university and I met all these people that worked on sound. Well, there were musicians. There were people who were making synthesizers. There were people who studied human language. There were people who studied anthropology. There were mm-hmm. people who studied psychology. And if you went to a musician, if you talked to Marty Hatch, who studies, you know, who is an expert in gamelons,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
he said, music isn't data, right? But if you go over to the engineering school and you're talking to somebody about, oh, I'm building this and this and this, it's data, right?
Right. Or Kim Haynes-Eitzen, who looks at desert yeah. sounds and the yeah. ancient religious spiritual texts yeah. that came out of those deserts.
So you see, there's that yeah. there's that dichotomy again, the yep. sort of the yin-yang.
Yep.
And on the one hand, you and I and everybody who's listening knows those moments you've had where a piece of music, a song, something just goes right into your soul and you begin to emote. You might cry, you might feel happiness. It's not data. It's
right.
not science. It's us, right?
Right? Right. And for me, it's also sound often triggers me to have almost the same physical reaction I had to whatever sound it was I heard 50 years ago or
Absolutely.
40 years ago. So I am like time traveling in my body.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this is when what started to really coalesce in my being and my mm-hmm. persona, and then at the same time I have an academic position and I have epaulets and I have all these kinds
yeah,
of
yeah.
things, right? It's like, no, it's the singing planet. Everywhere I went, whether it was in Central Africa, mm-hmm. you know, and the little tiniest insects that are stridulating on a goldenrod plant, or the largest animal ever to live on this planet, the blue whale, they're all singing. And in 1991, something happened to me which has changed my life dramatically. The Soviet Union collapsed. And through a friend of mine, a very good, lifelong friend, called me up and said, you're going to get a phone call and take the phone call. And what it was that at that point, Clinton was coming into administration and he had mm-hmm. a vice president who was then a Senator Gore, and a group of Republicans and Democrats, it was a functional
bipartisan
yeah, group, yeah, yeah. said, we're going to take some of the technology that the military and taxpayers' dollars have paid for, and we're going to use it to understand the planet. And I was selected by the U.S. Navy to be their chief marine mammal scientist to use the underwater listening systems for the anti-submarine listening systems in both the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean. I was the one who was asked to come in and see if I could use those to understand whales and their migrations and count them. And this is literally analogous to standing on the side of the hill with that little telescope that my grandfather gave me when I was 12 that would extend and contract.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and I would
mm-hmm.
look at things and it'd be a little bit bigger, to going into this magical barn and suddenly it's the Hubble telescope.
Right.
It completely turned my perspective on the globe, on the mm-hmm. world, on who I was and what I was doing. Because when I looked at the globe, where I had been and what I was doing and what the questions I was asking would fit under the tip of a pencil.
Yep.
But at the same time, now that's sort of a metaphor,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
at the same time when I flew back from Europe or the United Kingdom, where I had been using some of these telescopes, and I flew over the ocean, I could literally look out of the window of the airplane, look at that ocean and say, there are whales down there. I was listening to them and I could hear them 2,000 miles away. So suddenly that whole perspective of space and time and frequency of mm-hmm. sound
sure.
just exploded mm-hmm. into, it's the difference between trying to look at some stars with your naked eyes and then being able to look into a distant galaxy,
yeah.
right? And that changed the way I thought about life.
So help me. How what changed? To describe what you've described the incident that provoked the change, but what changed in the way that you appreciated it, the way you chunked the material, the way you processed it?
Well, some of it, it has to do with being willing and able and capable and knowledgeable that it can happen, that you can move between scales. But you can move over different spatial temporal scales. So literally when someone says, oh, well, you're working at 60,000 feet perspective. Well, yeah, because I could go from 60,000 foot, literally, Clay, I could be looking down on an ocean, like the Atlantic Ocean, the Pacific Ocean, and it could essentially be looking down that ocean and say, okay, I want to go to this part of the ocean, I want to listen to it. And I want to follow these voices of these great majestic singers. I want to follow them over this space. But it's not over a day or an hour. It's over years.
Right.
So then as you learn to move through these dimensions of everything from an hour to a decade, and then you move from a space that's the size of, you know, Cape Cod Bay to the size of an ocean basin, and then you're moving from frequency scales from things that are so low that you and I can't hear them to things that are so high in pitch that you and I can't hear them,
right,
where the bats and the dolphins are in sonar land and the blue whales are and the elephants are in infrasonic, and you realize it's all connected. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of being free enough with your mind to move between these different scales. So I realized how prejudiced I was in what I was listening to and my perception of the singing planet.
Right.
And that the song, well, here's another, and I'm jumping around here, but when we were working in Central Africa when pygmies were our guides, they knew the jungle, right? We were their guests, right?
Right.
I couldn't speak their language, they couldn't speak my language. But literally, when we sat down around an open fire one night, we started making rhythms. We started drumming, right?
Right, yeah.
And suddenly, we started singing with each other, just making up or using our voices.
Vocalization, basically.
Right?
Yeah.
And what happened? We became brothers and sisters, right? We completely bonded. Mm-hmm. The next day, when we woke up, we were joyous. Yeah. And that is what we need more of. We need more of those episodes of bonding and joyousness.
Right.
And so when I move, when I'm trying to explain this sense of being able to move from a perspective as though it's that phenomenal pictures coming back from the moon and you see the blue planet.
Right.
All the way down and flying into the ocean somewhere, flying into a jungle or flying into an urban environment. We've been listening off of Boston. We put hydrophones and recorders off of New York City. And what did we hear off New York City? We heard some of the greatest ocean voices that you'll ever hear. Blue whales and fin whales singing right off of the Verrazano Bridge.
Wow.
Right? And people totally forget. Right?
That life is there.
That life is there.
For the most part.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so where I can lead this conversation is when I think about my role and what I can do with my knowledge and my energy and my explorative,
sure,
unending of explorative ideas is to share it, right, and to translate it into pictures, visions, poetry, whatever it is. It's not about science anymore. It's about all of us, right?
It's about understanding, appreciation, engagement.
Right. So this is where, now I'm going to get back to Ithaca. Ithaca is a phenomenally generous, socially aware community that we take for granted. We can't take it for granted. It's unique. There are very few places in our country just look at how many things have been seeded here and grown here and imagined here and then go out and bloom. And this is where we are unique in that sense that the community cultures this kind of attitude of giving and thinking and being generous and receptive to our thoughts.
Right. And I I have seen that from many points of view, and we have been that more or less in different ways over the last years. We were also a company town, but it was a company town of manufacturing companies 75 years ago, and they went belly up in the late 70s for the most part. Mm-hmm. But Cornell was beginning to, and Ithaca College were stepping in after World War II,
yeah.
and to work, and we've had issues.
But also by no means it's perfect.
No. Sure. But what I want to go back to you, your story, and I want to walk it to the same place you've just gone, but I want to do it in a slightly different way. We are, to some extent, prisoners of our ability to observe.
Mm.
And when we find that our observations can be different than what we thought they were, we have to say, am I going to be open to that, or am I going to try to wall that out?
Mm-hmm.
And that is something you got as an explorer.
Mm-hmm.
It's something you also got up, I would imagine, in part of your own making your life, father be damned, and mother kind of, and sisters and everybody helping me out. What I do with Shared Journeys, which is the group that I work for, is we have this circle of symbols, and there are 37 symbols, which are, each one represents a different way of knowing how the world is and ought to be. It's intellectual, it's emotional, it's physical. Mm-hmm. Some of them are science-based, some of them are religion-based, some of them are culture-based, some of them are political, economic. But we try to get people to say, honestly, yes, I work out of many different ways of knowing the world, and they're not all compatible,
mm-hmm.
but they happen at the same time. And we need to figure out how to bring them in. So if I can touch somebody to think in a way that's more typical of a conservative Muslim or a moderate or liberal Muslim or of a conservative Christian or a scientist who practices in an engineering mode as opposed to a more of a physics mm-hmm. mode, you know, these are all ways that people get to see into things that they never would have thought. And when you bring the wonder the way you just described it, most people's response is one of respect and engagement and awe. It just takes time and kind of setting on the fear a little bit to let that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'm preaching, and I'm sorry. That's just
No. It's been a challenge to do that.
Yeah. No, it is a challenge to do that.
But at the same time, it's like any challenge of exploration. It's exhilarating because there is a reward, and one of the greatest gifts of that reward is that it's not about you.
Right.
And I learned something. I remember this statement that going into a Eskimo elder's tent on the ice, and it's very dangerous out there. And he said, on the ice, the most important person is the person standing next to you. I sort of looked, and he said, because that person will save your life, and they expect you will save theirs.
Right.
And I just remember, God, you're absolutely right. And it is that this is what we need to do as a society, and not vacate our soul to ourselves.
Right.
And
let's cut. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Let's cut to a piece of music, and then I have a couple of questions I want to ask, and then we'll close with music. Which would you like to play for the penultimate song? We've got Annie DeFranco and Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Young.
Oh, how about Annie?
Okay, here we go. Buildings and Bridges.
Buildings and bridges are made to bend in the wind, to withstand the wordless world takes. All its steel and stone are no match for the air, my friend. Doesn't bend breaks, what doesn't bend breaks. Thank you. and scab and heal and bleed again, and turn every scar into a joke. We are made to fight and fuck and talk and fight again, and sit around and laugh until we choke. Sit around and laugh until we choke. La la da da, la la. Some bitch who does not budge with eyes the size of snow. I may get pissed off sometimes, but you seem like the type to hold a grudge. And in the end, I just let it go. Yeah, in the end, I just let it go. La 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 la. For the air, my friend. What doesn't bend breaks. What doesn't bend breaks. What doesn't bend breaks. La 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 la.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Chris Clark. So, Chris, the way I like to end the show is, you know, you have an exciting practice in life, but I want to get practical in some little ways. And so what is it that you do on a daily basis, weekly, monthly, annual basis, to restore or rebalance yourself emotionally, physically, and intellectually? Because we oftentimes don't think of how we need to kind of work on all those different dimensions. What do you do? Or do you have a conscious practice? Or do you just live full throttle?
There's both.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine, given right. what you said.
And this is where you become... you exercise the consciousness part, and then it becomes unconscious. You mm-hmm. just do it.
Yeah, habit.
And so one of the biggest challenges, and since I love the living planet, I'm not necessarily enamored with human beings.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we do remarkable things. If you watch an artist or a musician or a scientist, and we put men on the moon, all these things are just phenomenal.
And I like to say that human beings have altered beyond recognition or destroyed every environment we've ever lived in. But we're also phenomenally inventive.
Yes, yes. We are very good at that. But I love the living planet.
Yep.
And I love that the magnificence of life, whether microscopic or, you know, phenomenally large. So one of the efforts I've really been dedicating myself to a lot has been scientific activism, I'd mm-hmm. call it, sort of a fairly straightforward form of words. So instead of devoting myself to writing papers and going to scientific conferences where you're basically, I mean, you could play scientific bingo at these things. If you could see whose name is on the agenda, you know what they're going to talk about, blah, 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 right? So it's really getting to the... the population at large, people at large, and so working with, so at the same time, having spent a lot of time in the Arctic mm-hmm. and then listen to the ocean on these enormous scales. One thing that is unfortunately brilliantly obvious when you listen to the ocean is how much pollution we're putting into the ocean from all our shipping traffic. I mean, 96% of all global commerce travels on ships, huge ships, which generate, and they're acoustically bleaching the ocean. Literally, you can't hear, animals can't hear each other. And there are no deaf whales or seals or fish. Everybody makes sound. Everybody has to listen. So this is a very practical.
Are no mute ones, you mean? Some, are they, are some of them deaf because of the noise, or are they?
Well,
there are no mute animals.
Yeah. Everybody, everybody makes sounds, and everybody listens, right? And now we're discovering, science is discovering that, oh, all these little things, these little invertebrates, they're doing it too. And then there's the other sad part of life, and that is when we explore for hydrocarbons and fossil fuels in the ocean, we set off explosions every 10 seconds for months at a time.
Right.
And nobody understands, most people have no idea that this is going on.
Right.
So I've dedicated a lot of my time over the last years to really public outreach and scientific activism to stop drilling and exploration in the Arctic. And most recently, over the last couple of years, it's been happening along the East Coast. Most people don't realize this is happening.
Right. And it's just been, I think, they've pulled back from it recently.
Yes, the Obama administration accepted a lot of the pressure and basically said, okay, we will not, we will take drilling off the table, but it didn't take exploration off the table, which is highly destructive.
And that's because of all the explosions that are set to kind of get the readings in the ground.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's what I've been working on really hard to do that. And a group of us have done it standing shoulder to shoulder.
Right.
And that's a real achievement.
Right. So that's the organized activist in you. What I want to go back to is the one who appreciates and loves the whole planet. So how is it that you talk about what you love that is beyond your comprehension and control, or just beyond the scope of what you can understand, but you still engage it, run after it, seek it? How do you convey that? I can see organizing the political pressure, but how do you convey that experience?
I let you listen. You can listen, and I'll give you the experience, the opportunities to listen.
So we can go to your acoustic.
We can go library. up into the cloud, and
yes,
you can listen.
Yes,
to these
but
things,
you can,
right?
And you will walk us through that.
Right. So when, for example, a music composition student, which is in a now a formalized process, I say, I'm not going to tell you what these are. I'm not going to tell you whether it's, you know, a sonata or it's a blue whale, whatever it is. Just listen to it.
Yeah.
And guess what? You hear the music, you hear the song,
yep.
And then you you ingest that into your mind, and you translate it, right?
And you begin to take it on, that which is beyond you.
Right. So one of the ways I often talk about, for example, humpback whales. Everybody, if anybody's going to know a whale song, it's going to be a humpback whale song. Mm-hmm. These were the songs made famous in the early 70s by Roger and Katy Payne, you know, Judy Collins, Paul Winter, and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Postcards from Heaven. And there are hundreds of people who study humpback song. Yeah. I don't care to know why humpbacks sing.
Right.
I just want to listen to them.
The song. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's the sort of dichotomy between drilling down and being this reductionistic kind of approach versus like, no, when I go out on a walk or I'm swimming in the ocean or sailing on the ocean or whatever it is, I just want to immerse myself in that. Right.
And the activist does both, and ideally without arrogance.
Absolutely.
With commission, but with commitment, but without arrogance.
I believe that if I provide these opportunities for as many people as possible, that they will absorb the essence of that magnificence, just as I have been able to do. And someone gave me that opportunity as well.
Chris, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you very much. This has been great.
We're going to close with Our House, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Do you want to say anything or no? Just let it play. This is Our House.
I'll light the fire. You place the flowers in the vase that you bought today. Staring at the fire.
cold.